Well, may it please the court, my name is...
Mr. Searswell, can I ask a preliminary question?
Absolutely, Your Honor. Absolutely.
Page 11 of your brief, you write, because of these suspensions, Collette, the attorney, quote, materially limited her own ability to prepare for trial and thereby prejudiced appellant's due process right to be adequately represented by counsel and for a fair trial.
Correct.
Isn't that a claim of ineffective assistance of counsel?
I think, Your Honor, the verbiage can really go in several different ways. One,
well, but you understand, if it is a claim for ineffective assistance of counsel, that's a habeas corpus claim.
Absolutely.
And we have no jurisdiction over habeas corpus.
I agree, Your Honor, and I think in footnote that I included, I think the only footnote, I think we acknowledge the inability to essentially attack strictly an ineffective argument on appeal to this tribunal.
Okay. All right, that said, your argument then becomes a Sixth Amendment denial of counsel argument.
Correct, Your Honor.
I want you to tell me what critical stages of this criminal proceedings your client was denied counsel. What dates?
I think that, Your Honor, on a particular date, if I could give one in particular, I'll just use, and I think this will go into maybe the legal part of April 21st, which is that, quote, status hearing, where I included in there the actual narrative between the court, the defendant, which appeared technically pro se, and also the Commonwealth.
What about, so you do not maintain your client was denied counsel on February the 14th?
I do, Your Honor. Somewhat interesting. I was giving my one example. That was the first day counsel allegedly made an appearance in this case that happened to be a period of time which she was suspended from the practice of law.
Did she know that? This started in the morning, and her suspension was effective that day.
Correct.
So
it's somewhat complicated.
I don't know whether she even knew it at that time.
And Your Honor, I could tell the court from being on the 7th District Committee for the Virginia State Bar, it's somewhat complicated knowing the exact time this sort of suspension would take place. And I think that there's even in the record the Commonwealth maintains that she appeared in the General District Court and maintained that. And what was interesting about the Commonwealth's representation at that time was that she acknowledged the possibility of a suspension and said to the court specifically, my license is intact.
Well,
so clearly there was
an
investigation.
She didn't say that on February 14th.
Not on February 14th. She didn't actually appear. She had noted her appearance. The Commonwealth made that comment.
She did appear on February 14th.
On February 14th. She made a comment out of separate hearing and where the Commonwealth said, well, she appeared today in the General District Court. Correction, I think that was on the 21st that I'm acknowledging.
Right, well, I'm talking about the 14th. You
correct, her first
he
appearance.
Was denied representation on the 14th of February.
At the initial arraignment. I think the complicating factor in that is that she ultimately was suspended. But I think in the circumstances, the actual proceeding, which would have been what I think is a critical stage in which
Why?
She was denied counsel on
there's
the 21st.
The transcript of the proceeding is one page.
Correct.
And the only thing that was done there, they set a later date for what they call processing, but I think it's for an arraignment.
Correct, Your Honor.
And they agreed on a discovery order to be entered.
On the 14th. Your Honor, I don't think...
Why is that a critical stage?
I think if we're looking at, well, one, it's a multi-part analysis in which we're kind of, one, determining what is a critical stage, which I think there's case law both accepted in the Fourth and the Sixth Circuit, in which really any pretrial proceeding is deemed a critical stage. But if we're
Has
taking the next step of
it. Has
that
been adopted by any Virginia court, by our state courts?
I think the Fourth Circuit has adopted it, but as far as the state court, this is why I think this issue, frankly, is ripe for the tribunal to make a decision on, because I think it is somewhat unsettled from a state court proceeding as to what our analysis is, especially as it comes to pretrial proceedings when we have these Sixth Amendment attachments.
Why is it unsettled in Virginia courts? We've said a number of times something is a critical stage and something isn't.
Agreed.
Why is it unsettled?
I think when you're dealing with pretrial proceedings, and especially looking at recent Fourth Circuit analysis and other analysis both from the state court, is and I'll use Your Honor's analysis. When looking at the 14th on its face, I think that counsel at least appeared. There was an agreement on an order. I don't think I could represent to the court that I can show you something prejudicial from that particular proceeding.
I mean,
I think the better example...
There's nothing in dispute.
On the 14th?
Yeah.
Correct. I think the better analysis is on the 21st,
right,
on that particular occasion when Mr. Weatherholt appeared, mm-hmm. and Your Honor acknowledged and brought the defendant and said, hey, your attorney has been suspended. She's not here. And at that particular occasion, the Commonwealth even chimed in and said, oh, this is a somewhat unique situation for us, which I think it is a unique situation in general. I haven't been able to contact her. I can't negotiate her. Went through kind of those issues there.
Well, now, that isn't what your client said on the 21st, is it?
Well, my client, well, and also a secondary issue of do we have maybe not even a waiver is appropriate, but we have some imperfect verbiage from the defendant in which he says, technically, she's been paid. I don't have money for another lawyer unless you appoint me one. The court does follow up.
But doesn't he also say that I'd like to continue with her? It's really just it's just all it is a status state. There's nothing that really occurs other than to determine whether they're going to keep the scheduled trial date, which
correct.
Ultimately is not kept.
Which is not kept.
So circling back to what Judge Haley has asked you, how is that a critical
correct.
Stage of the
this is the interesting analysis
process of the proceeding?
Your Honor, I think it's a good question, and under the circumstances, it's funny. I actually use, and I'll cite the Commonwealth's case they use in the Van V. Jones case of kind of determining what pretrial hearings are, quote, critical. And in that case, what the interesting point that they make, and they actually quote, is that we reiterate our view that plea negotiations, guilty plea hearings, and sentencing hearings are all critical stages, giving kind of a blanket recitation of what would be appropriate. But what I think is most interesting is included in that particular is that it says plea negotiations.
But what is impacted, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. What right of the appellant is impacted in a status hearing when all the court's trying to determine is really something that's nothing more than scheduling? Do we go forward? Do we continue it?
Do you need a lawyer? Do you have a lawyer?
That's correct, Your Honor. What I think, just to answer specifically what I think about this particular case is, the Commonwealth in that hearing on the record says, I haven't been able to get in touch with her. I haven't been able to negotiate with her. When we have the definition of critical proceedings, at least in the Sixth Circuit, adopted by the Fourth and separate case law.
Now, hold on. Can you tell me where I can't negotiate with her until I know she's reinstated? Okay. But the court goes on and says, this is where we are, you know. The Sixth Amendment guarantees the right to counsel. This is the counsel he wants, and this is his counsel.
Your Honor, I think when you read the court's interaction with Mr. Weatherholt, I don't deny at some point in that interaction he says, I've paid her, I want to get this over with. I want her. I don't deny he made that statement. I can't ignore the fact that he also made a request earlier on that he didn't have money to hire an attorney and essentially implied that he would need appointed counsel, which, of course, did not happen.
But again, doesn't all of this get to the issue of do you have an attorney? What attorney do you want? Do you want to go for all of that is preliminary relating to your Sixth Amendment right. It's not a
right.
critical stage of the proceeding.
And that, it's
I mean, it's oftentimes that, you know, somebody's trotted in front of the judge. You say, do you have counsel? Nope. Okay, we'll appoint you one.
Right. And Your Honor, I can't dispute that because I think that's what the record establishes. But I'll use an example of a case, Mitchell v. Mason, also from the Sixth, in which the court analyzed.
Did you cite that in your brief?
I don't believe I did, Your Honor. It's 325 F3D.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
325 F3D 732.
Is it in the Commonwealth's brief?
It's actually included extensively in the Van V. Jones case,
okay.
And also adopted by the Fourth Circuit in Graves v. Padula. But what I like so much is that, and this is maybe why I should have analyzed it more in the brief, but what I like about that particular case is, for the critical stage Sixth Amendment analysis, again, not a Strickland analysis, not anything else related to ineffective assistance, focused on a Sixth Amendment argument, they focused on the suspension of counsel in the time preceding trial. The analogous argument I'm making here, which is uncontroverted, that representation by Ms. Collette took place in approximately two and a half month period, and for 19 days of that, she was technically suspended from the practice of law, including the week prior to the scheduled trial date, I'll acknowledge that didn't take place and didn't happen for another week.
How does that impact your argument, though, if the trial's actually continued as to whether this is a critical period? If you're essentially saying, look, for 2 weeks she's unavailable to appellant to go through trial strategy, defense, whatever, mm-hmm. how is that impacted if really it's not close to the time of trial? Because that sounds like what you were arguing.
I think the court's analysis and ultimate determination needs to be in when we assess this critical period, how we view these pretrial proceedings and kind of when we're looking at this unique case, which again they did in that Mitchell v. Mason case, can we and should we, which I urge the court to do, look at the length of time retained or appointed counsel is actually active practice law prior to the trial date?
Well, suppose Ms. Collette said on one of these weeks of suspension, I'm going to Nag's Head with my husband for a week. Well, she said that. I mean, it probably happens all the time.
It certainly does, and it probably scared me. I would.
So would you argue that if Ms. Collette had been down at Nag's Head with her husband for a week, that he was denied counsel?
I think you'd be talking about an example, Your Honor, where counsel made a choice about their life and what they're going to do. I think the focus is more on the actual ability to do her job in practice law, which is the complicating factor, I think, in this particular case.
Well, if you're down in North Carolina, it's going to be hard to appear in court in Virginia.
Very much so. But that would be a determination or decision from counsel, her inability to practice, if she wanted to.
Then we're supposed to ask for counsel's day book for the month before trial and say, well, what were you doing in the month before trial?
Well, Your Honor, I think, again, the
How
focus
many hours
is not
did you
on.
Spend in preparation?
Correct. For example, if I was, a week before trial on a case I had last week, that's not the analysis here because I think under the circumstances, we have a situation in which we have an attorney in a 2 month period of time leading up to trial where for at least 19 days could not practice law, not chose not to. We're dealing with.
Well, does that mean she can't prepare for trial?
I think under the circumstances, it certainly impacts her ability to prepare for trial, subpoena witnesses, act as counsel.
Why?
Because then we're going to have circumstances in which if she is engaging in the practice of law during her suspension, she's got a separate disciplinary proceedings with the bar. So the answer is, can she sit at home and do something by herself? Maybe. Could she sit down and prepare and review her own legal research? Sure. But as far as actually preparing for trial, she can't do that for 19 days for the more formal things that counsel are required to do.
Tell me why she can't.
For example, she couldn't issue subpoenas. She couldn't do anything else in her purview as a licensed attorney because for that period of time she is suspended.
We have really asked you, or I have asked you perhaps too many questions.
I
note that y'all didn't claim this judge was biased till after the conviction. Why'd you wait till then?
I will advise the court. Obviously, I came into this case after trial. I was not trial counsel. Answer number one.
I've been doing this for a number of years, and we can't impose the sins of trial counsel upon appellate counsel.
And it's always tough, Your Honor, to come in after and do the same thing.
No question about it.
But I think under the circumstances, this is an interesting and not uncommon case, as Your Honor's experience in kind of more day-to-day, of when we have ex-government, prosecutorial situated counsel being appointed to the bench, that always creates, and it does for private counsel too, situations in where there raises a potential conflict. And under the circumstances, what's interesting about this case is we're dealing with a bench trial. We're dealing with a situation where ultimately in their decision, which is quoted in the brief and in the record, really the decision came down to the credibility of one person, a confidential informant. Not uncommon, actually fairly common in these sort of cases. But what makes this more unique is during the case and then ultimately found out later by trial counsel is this then Commonwealth attorney, now sitting judge in this particular case, acknowledged that he had prosecuted this confidential informant. Then simultaneously on the record, there's extensive testimony from both the investigators and some acknowledgement from the court that this confidential informant was used during his time as a Winchester City prosecuting attorney. So I think when we're dealing with...
He prosecuted the witness.
And twofold. Prosecuted the witness, but also used him as a confidential informant for other prosecutions.
Okay.
So, yeah, totally agree. Obviously prosecuted the witness and also knows about his extensive criminal history.
Ways,
it cuts
right?
both ways.
Yeah.
Well, didn't the court say, I have no memory whatsoever of dealing with this person?
Counsel, I'm going to allow. I'm going to put 2 minutes back on your time. We've asked you a lot of questions, but please answer Judge Haley's
question. I think Judge Iden absolutely put on the record that in his position, he didn't have any independent recollection. And it kind of, under the circumstances, leads into that second question raised by counsel was, at the same time, Judge Iden presided over another prosecution for the confidential informant just before this particular prosecution of Mr. Weatherholt. Now, the complicating factor is, in assessing credibility, and to answer the judge's question, I think that could cut both ways, too. But under the circumstances, I think with the issue of dealing with potential bias or prejudice, at least from the outside, and whether or not Judge Iden abused his discretion in saying, I can remain a neutral fact finder for this particular case, the complicating factor is we're dealing with someone who has, by his own admission, used this informant in the past for other prosecutions. I think when we have that situation, we would be hard-pressed to believe or in a position to say that the court, sitting as a neutral fact finder, has not already made a determination because he's used this individual in other prosecutions that this person is credible, that they may be used to prosecute cases, that if we come to a question of whether or not to believe this, because there was a lot of evidence and controversy in this case, that determination has kind of already been made by now sitting judge based on his experience in the Commonwealth Attorney's Office. And I think that begs the question of whether or not, and we would say that he has, abused his discretion in not refusing to hear this case.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Ashwell.
Thank you, Your
Honor. Some additional time for you in just a minute, but we're going to hear from Mr. Jones. Morning, Mr. Jones.
Good morning. May it please the court. I am John Jones on behalf of the Commonwealth, and we're asking the court to affirm the trial court's decision to convict Mr. Weatherholt, because first, there was no denial of counsel, and any questions of ineffective assistance of counsel are reserved, as the court has already observed.
Mr. Jones, he makes a discreet argument that it's actually the inability to prepare and not necessarily whether she was effective or not in the typical sense that you think of in terms of a habeas. Do you want to address that she was not able to do subpoenas or engage in discussions with the Commonwealth Attorney as it relates to plea agreements? I think that's his position in terms of why this might be defined as a critical period or stage.
Yes, Your Honor, that is an inquiry that comes up frequently in habeas proceedings and in habeas petitions of inadequate preparation for trial. That's a question that is reserved solely for habeas proceedings under Strickland analysis. And, you know, really to reading the analysis in the opening brief on this issue, they're citing to a lot of habeas cases, but trying to call it something different so that it can fit within direct appeal. And that's just not appropriate. It doesn't change the nature of the analysis. It's still a habeas question, whatever name that you want to call it. But at any rate, that is a question. He'll have an opportunity to litigate that if he wants to in habeas corpus. It's just not for this court. And I think maybe some of the difficulties in the answering some of the questions of what exactly happened and what the finer points and specifics of how her representation might have been impacted by her suspension reflects that direct appellate courts are not confronted with this question very often because the place to raise these kind of claims is in habeas. Habeas courts see them all the time, and there's a separate set of standards for evaluating them. And so I would ask the court, encourage the court not to treat this as anything other than a habeas claim in that respect. And I think also the point that was made from the bench that, you know, the reason for the unavailability for 2 weeks or 3 weeks or whatever period of time, if it's a de minimis period of time, with the example of a vacation being taken and whether that would constitute a Sixth Amendment denial of straight denial of counsel for the purposes of direct appeal, and obviously that is an untenable standard, and that invites courts to get into attorneys' personal lives in ways that I don't think would be manageable for the courts to handle. So that can't form the basis of a claim of denial of counsel. I think that
are you aware of cases, Virginia cases, other than Browning, which was 19 Virginia Ave, that discuss what is in fact a critical stage? That's one of the questions counsel raised, that said that hadn't been.
Yes, Your Honor.
Extensively, defined in Virginia.
Kozik versus Director of the Department of Corrections.
I'm sorry, what?
Kozik, K-O-Z-I-C-H, is cited in our brief in the standard of review section for the first issue.
Yeah, and that's a habeas, isn't it?
It's a habeas, but it does.
Just saying.
Absolutely. But it does state generally applicable principles of law for determining what is a critical stage. There's not a different rule in habeas for what is a critical stage versus direct appeal. So it is definitely applicable. But it lays out that whether a proceeding is a critical stage turns on, quote, the likelihood of substantial prejudice to the client's rights during the particular confrontation and the ability of counsel to help avoid that prejudice. So, A, it has to be during a confrontation for a straight Sixth Amendment analysis as to whether.
The Sixth Amendment right is basically linked to stages of the proceedings, not the trial prep or the negotiation of plea agreements.
Yes, Your
Honor. Is your point.
Absolutely. And it does focus on proceedings and appearances in court.
The theory is you don't have to go to court without a lawyer.
Yes, Your Honor.
If there's going to be something critical occurring.
Yes, Your Honor. The right to be represented in court is what straight Sixth Amendment analysis, and the reason I call it straight Sixth Amendment analysis is because Strickland is based on the Sixth Amendment as well. It's just sort of a subset, but
it's a collateral proceeding.
Yes,
on a Sixth Amendment basis.
But for the purposes of actual denial of counsel, it focuses on whether during a proceeding in the court the person was without counsel and whether that proceeding was a critical stage of the prosecution.
But there are two cases, Browning that you're aware of and Kozak, that deal with what is a critical stage?
Kozak, the case that I just, and I can.
Department of Corrections versus Kozak, 290 Virginia. Right?
Yes, Your Honor, that's accurate. So that's another one that fleshes it out a little bit more. The block quote in from Van versus Jones that we cited to sort of highlighting the dangers of calling procedural hearings such as the February 14th, even if, assuming without conceding that he was effectively without counsel for that February 14th hearing, that was manifestly not a critical stage in the proceedings, and to call it anything else would I think problematic for other cases going forward where the attorney was perhaps unavailable for a more reasonable justification.
What about the April 21 hearing?
The April 21st hearing, obviously that was called for the specific purpose of letting him know that his attorney was suspended and getting his position on whether or not he would like to retain her and move forward with her or to get another attorney. And I think, just reading the plain text of his responses to the court and his averral that he wanted to continue with Ms. Collette as his attorney, I think that, to try to read that as anything other than a voluntary choice to continue with her despite the fact that he knew that she was having
status
problems.
Status hearing to inquire as to counsel.
Yes. It was a status hearing. Absolutely, Your Honor. And in Johnson versus Zerbst from the U.S. Supreme Court makes the point that whether to proceed with retained counsel, to seek appointed counsel, is a choice that an individual defendant must make. And so, it's unclear to me how counsel's advice would be even relevant here, especially given the fact that if he'd had counsel at that hearing, it would have been the counsel that he would have been seeking to relieve.
Is it safe to say that that April 21st hearing was essentially the trial court trying to protect the defendant's Sixth Amendment right?
Yes, Your Honor. It was definitely that, and it was just giving him an opportunity to seek to get new counsel if he wanted to. He decided not to.
Indeed, the trial court specifically cited the Sixth Amendment constitutional right in that hearing.
Yes, Your Honor. And so Mr. Weatherholt, by making a decision that by the Constitution's bedrock principles was his to make alone, and making that decision to move forward with Ms. Collette, he can't now come back and charge the court with some kind of error in allowing him to make that decision. So the fact is that when things resumed and when the bench trial was set and there was adequate time to prepare, Ms. Collette was representing him at the critical stages of the proceeding. So there wasn't an actual denial of counsel for the purpose of the Sixth Amendment here.
What about the, moving along, the bias question?
On the bias question first, the court has already addressed, I think, both of the main points here, but it's not properly preserved. 5A18 bars arguments on appeal that weren't raised at the proper time below. And the proper time to raise a claim of bias is certainly not after one has already been convicted. Where the facts...
Well, it was a timely motion, wasn't it?
It was timely in the sense that it was brought before the court before this case was final, but...
Yeah, before, within 21 days.
Yes, Your Honor. But the point that I wanted to make is that there's case law to support the proposition that a motion for recusal, especially one alleging bias here, has to be brought within a reasonable time of when the basis of that motion is known. And to allow someone to bring a post-trial motion for recusal based on facts that were known long before the trial occurred.
How do we know they were known?
Because they're all based on the identity of the trial judge and the interactions that Mr. Weatherholt had had with him before, and also on the proceedings that were going on with the confidential informant, Mr. Scholl.
How do you respond to opposing counsel's argument, which I thought was an interesting one on the procedural bar point, which is that it wasn't until as things unfolded that you could clearly identify the significance of the particular witness, at which point in time then you say, uh-oh, maybe there's a problem here?
Well, Your Honor, I would just...
It's creative, and I just...
Yeah, and I think that, it's the standard is knew or should have known with the exercise of reasonable diligence.
You're saying just the name of the witness should have raised the red flag.
The name of the witness and
how,
the fact
how can that
he,
be enough, Mr. Jones? If wouldn't that require independent investigation unless something else comes to light?
Well, to say that the confidential informant who acted as a buyer for a sting operation, that they wouldn't have known that he might have been a significant witness in this prosecution kind of defies credulity to me, because that in all of these kinds of prosecutions where a sting operation was conducted, the confidential informant, the buyer that went in and conducted the buy, is always going to be an important witness in these prosecutions. I also think that perhaps Mr. Weatherholt's case has overstated the significance of Mr. Scholl somewhat, because if you read the brief, you get the indication that Mr. Scholl was the only evidence against him. But there was also inculpatory statements made on the jail call recordings. And
right, but that's not really relevant to the issue of whether the judge had a bias or not.
No, Your Honor, but it's relevant to the issue of how significant Mr. Scholl was. Is that he wasn't that significant.
Yeah, but that goes more to like a sufficiency argument in terms of how do you credit his testimony as opposed to what Judge Decker is saying, which is in terms of whether the judge gave it undue consideration.
Yes, Your Honor. And also to that point, whether recusal was required is question that's left to the sound discretion of the trial court. And so to establish an abuse of discretion, Mr. Weatherholt would have to be able to prove actual bias, not just a possibility or even a probability of bias, but actual bias. And nothing in these pleadings rises above just raising a possibility of bias based on previous interactions. And I would further note that the trial court held a fulsome evidentiary hearing on this question and made factual findings that there was no bias, and also factual findings relevant to that finding that, you know, he had not imported facts from the Clark County proceeding.
And further, that he had absolutely no memory of.
Yes, Your Honor, and that he had no memory of from which he could have imported information.
Yeah, which he could.
Yeah. Yes, Your Honor. So I think manifestly, but I would stand first on the procedural bar, because to allow defendants to get, to recognize a judge and to know that they've had run-ins with that judge before, and to be able to go and look up in the court records and see that he's also had interactions with this confidential informant, and to be able to sit on that through the trial, find out, oh, I got convicted, and then bring a post-trial motion for recusal and get a second bite of the apple potentially from that would be entirely inappropriate and set up a real problematic incentive. So for all those reasons, if the court doesn't have additional questions, the Commonwealth just asks the court to affirm.
All right, thank you. I promise Mr. Ashwell just a little bit of additional time.
And I'll keep it very brief, Your Honor, and I thank you. I'll try to keep it to these two issues. I think the court has tried to kind of elicit from both counsel, and that is, one, determining critical stage, which I think is ultimately what we have to do. And I think, and again, and I cited, and I provided the cite for the Mason v. Mitchell case, which again was cited in the Van v. Jones case by the Commonwealth, in which not applying Strickland, not applying ineffective assistance, found a Sixth Amendment denial, which is again what we're asking for the following factual principles. We held that Evelyn's, which is counsel's, total absence during the period of his suspension from practice, and then near total absence from the time which he wasn't suspended, which approximately was 6 months, constituted a Sixth Amendment violation requiring reversal. We're putting forth the same argument here today because factually they're almost identical. Under the circumstances, we have a much shorter period of time. Representation starting February 2017, trial ultimately happening in May. During that time period, a significant portion, she was not able to practice law. So I think.
Are you aware of any case that supports the proposition that the Sixth Amendment right, a straight appellate Sixth Amendment right, attaches to trial prep as opposed to proceedings, critical proceedings?
I think under the circumstances, courts have been split. To answer your question specifically, looking at mostly different circuits versus state opinions, I would say there is a split between applying a Strickland standard to trial prep analysis and then using trial prep to kind of bootstrap into a Sixth Amendment critical stage argument. So I have seen both. And I can advise the court just today, I read one where the court applied a Strickland analysis to trial prep alone, and it's actually.
Okay, but I'm not talking about Strickland, because Strickland gets into habeas. I'm talking
correct.
About a straight appellate Sixth Amendment right challenge where it's been applied to pretrial prep as opposed to a critical stage of a the court proceedings.
And counsel, I'm going to allow you to answer her question, but your time is
up. I appreciate the honor. The answer, Your Honor, is that I haven't seen it in that direct analysis, but yes to the inability to do so much, and the inability to. Thank you all for running over my time, but I appreciate it. Thank you all.
We're going to come down.